All right. That's a little bit of Mark O'Connor and the Mark O'Connor Band. And we're joined in the studio. Mark O'Connor is here. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Also here with Will Ransom, who's the artistic director at Juno Jazz and Classics. And you're here in town because the festival finale is happening tomorrow night, 7:30 at Centennial Hall is when it's happening. You're going to be on stage with the whole band, playing for hours and hours and hours.
That band we just listened to. That's, yeah. One of the cuts from our new live album, Mark O'Connor Band, and we'll be playing that and a bunch more tunes, and we have a lot of vocals. We have three lead singers in my family that joins me on stage, and so it's really a remarkable musical time for me.
But speaking of remarkable music, you've had a pretty remarkable career in music. I mean, it has been kind of all over the map, different styles, different kind of metamorphosis of styles, different instruments, different groups that you've played with.
Yeah.
So you were just telling me you're celebrating 45 years in recorded music,
yeah,
and you have 45 albums to your name.
45 feature albums in the 45 years.
And he's only 42 years old.
And it's amazing. He's gone back in time.
Can you imagine that? It feels like that, really.
But you did start when you were really a kid. You were 12 when you recorded your first album.
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah.
I had a Rounder record contract, and those were in my teen years. And then I had a Warner Brothers record contract in my 20s, and then I got to Sony Classical in my 30s, and then I developed my own label and have lots of releases on that as well.
Let's talk about the kind of the way you might sort of define how you metamorphosize through the years in a way, because your musical style has really ebbed and flowed in different kind of categories and mm-hmm. and sort of actually has maybe even developed its own category of music.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I've really let my violin in particular really lead the way. The talent I have to play that instrument and the music that I'm able to write for it, could range from a fiddle tune to a caprice to a concerto to a jazz tune. And Americana and folk and all kinds of stuff along the way.
What caught your interest in it to begin with? What was the thing that really made you feel like, wow, that's this instrument that really I can express myself on?
Yeah, I think it was great fiddle music, American fiddling. I grew up in Seattle, not too far from here, but far away from the traditional music of the South, which I was able to really be inspired by through long play recordings. I see you have a turntable
turntable.
They're back. I can't tell you how many times I picked up the needle, backed it up, an eighth of an inch to catch a lick that I was learning. I learned a lot that way. I also had great teachers and mentors. The Texas fiddle legend Benny Thomason was retired in the Seattle area, and he became my principal teacher. I had tons of great, great mentors. Stefan Grappelli became a final teacher for me when I was 17 and 18 and toured around the country with him. So, I think that it really is through the violin that I got inspired by music and being an artist.
But there's many people that would have they kind of get that calling. They have incredible talent. And then they really have a genre and they stick with that genre. It sort of speaks to them but you haven't done that in your career. You've really wanted to explore all different areas. What is it that kind of calls you to move into different areas?
Well, I think the compositions, the ideas for music itself, that really is the thing that leads me. So like, for instance, if I'm doing a Nashville recording session and then in pops, an idea for, the fiddle concerto, I mean, I could either sit on that and just ignore it or figure out, man, can I take this to a symphony orchestra? Can I talk to a conductor in putting this on stage? Because after all, I've written it, so it's a responsibility to the art to the literature. I can either have someone else play it, or I can try to figure out how to play it myself professionally. So that's what I've done. You know, at the very beginning, I probably didn't necessarily aspire to do all that. But, you know, along the way, I mean, like, for instance, our new group, the Mark O'Connor Band, I didn't aspire to have a family group. I never thought that was possible in my family. But all these young people around me, their names are O'Connor, yeah, all of a sudden get really good. And so it's like you're sort of looking at the literature, you're looking at the musical artistry, and then you have to deal with it. Like, do you ignore it? Do I ignore my family members who are really good and don't play with them professionally? Or do you say, you know what, I'm going to make a sacrifice. I'm going to set this thing aside, and then I'm going to go down this road for a while, see where it takes me. And that's been my musical career.
Do you think growing up in Seattle, that was actually kind of away from – you weren't indoctrinated into a whole culture of the music, right? It wasn't on the front porch everywhere you were. So it's, in some ways, did that allow you to feel like you had a more experimental mindset when you approached playing?
Yeah, I guess you could say that I did not get trapped into a system. We were really begging for any system to be involved with up in Seattle that produced something that was, you know, beautiful music. But most of the time I started entering competitions, fiddle contests and guitar contests around the country and back east in the Southwest. And that really enabled me to figure out that I could really perform on stage under pressure, and it attracted a lot of veteran musicians to me, and they looked after me, took me under their wing. I mean, like, you know, musicians like Doc Watson, who happened to be one of the judges of the first national guitar championship I entered. And so, you know, just kind of like checking all these boxes off, going, well, I've played for David Grisman, I've played for Stephan Grappelli, and now Doc Watson and Tony Rice, and it just kept snowballing.
Right, right.
And then when I was, a later teen, then they actually started to want to hire me to play with them. Mm. And that was the beginning of my career.
Was have you always had it's interesting to me that you mentioned performing specifically and sort of getting confidence as a performer. Is performing on stage something that you separate from when you're playing in a studio or playing in order to compose? I mean, do you really think in terms of, okay, I'm on stage, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
This is about people watching me and I'm making it really an entertainment.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think about a lot?
Yeah. They're different, different paintbrushes for the canvas. I mean, you know, there's a lot of composers that don't play very well and are not very good performers, and vice versa. So, I mean, I was really interested in doing it all. You know, I realized that I had a talent for creating music, for composing and writing. I had a talent for leading groups and arranging music for groups. Back to the symphonic literature, I've composed 9 concertos and 2 symphonies and over 700 performances of my music with symphony orchestras in the country. So it's really a remarkable and a journey for me.
Yeah.
You know, like nothing was really predictable about it. And I think I've, you know, created a new genre, which is genre-less. You know, like for especially for my instrument, violin, we're proving, and through the O'Connor method that we teach now all around the country, around the world, that learning the violin, you don't have to be stuck in a particular style. It doesn't have to be just classical or just old time or just anything. It could be, you know, American string playing. And what could that mean? Well, everything that's involved in the American scene should include the violin. And it once did, you know, 100 years ago, the violin was the most prevalent instrument in American music. And now you really can't say that, which is so unfortunate. But I think it's because we've been teaching the violin. We've been teaching the violin to be an exclusive kind of situation where we're forgetting or leaving out things on purpose for students. And I think that's a real musical crime. I think that students can handle a lot more than what we've been giving them, especially for strings, because we start kids so young. They've got tons of time to catch up and get it all in. You know, we're not in a race. You know, I mean, if you start young, you have years to look at fiddle tunes and years to look at jazz and years to look at classical. I mean, you know, we can really open it up.
Mm. Are you a teacher? Do you like teaching? Is that part of a big part of what you're into? Or are you someone that has your own thing, you like to play, and you don't want to be kind of spending your time teaching people?
Well, I teach classes. I've been in residencies for years, whether it's at university or with an orchestra. And then we sponsor our own camps or string camps and workshops and master classes, and I teach teachers. So I'm a teacher trainer.
Oh, okay, cool.
And I do that a lot. Teachers come from all around the country and parts of the world to take my seminars. So while I don't have any private students, which is a whole nother responsibility that a musician like me would be hard to find that kind of time. But I'm teaching a lot out there. And then bringing teachers along with me so they in turn can inspire their students with this material.
Has there been points in your career where you've felt stuck or where you've felt like I've reached the end of my limit on what I'm doing, I need to break out of this? Does that occur to you, or has it just been a kind of a easy flow from one thing into the next?
Some of it has been some of it is like you hit a wall. I did that in Nashville. When I was a session player, I really loved being a session player for a while. I helped so many artists on their albums. I mentioned I had 45 feature albums. Well, I'm on 450 albums.
Really?
Yeah, as a session player.
450 albums.
Yeah, in addition to mine. So
that's has it ever felt like a slog? Has
it
ever?
Really, yeah. You almost feel like you're a robot in the factory almost. And I resented that.
And they want like one certain thing out of you, sort of. You get known for this one.
You get known for something.
Thing. Yeah, right.
And then it is very dangerous, I think, to an artist because you can be a parody of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that was happening to me even in my 20s, where it's like, Mark, we really liked what you did about 5 years ago. That was just exactly what we want now.
That's such an allure, right? Because that's lucrative. That's a way to make money in the music business, which is a thing that so many musicians aspire to, just that, being able to have a career. So that's a real risk to break out of that, I would think.
It was at that time because I broke out of it when I was still at the height of it. But now there is no scene like that anymore. I actually went back to Nashville last week. Some of the band members in our group live in Nashville. But I went back last week and I was talking to some people about it, my old New Nashville Cat cohorts from the 80s and 90s. And they said, yeah, the scene has changed. There is no full-time session player like there used to be, like I was. And I wasn't just a full-time session player. I was a double-scale and triple-scale session player.
Is that because the studio system has sort of changed? There's not the sort of it's become much more disparate. People are recording on their own, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, can you imagine the session drummer, right? Like if you could keep a beat and have every kind of groove in your hands, that's a session drummer. You want that person on your record because no matter what kind of song you wrote, that drummer can play it and play it perfectly and get a great track. Well, now it doesn't matter how good the drummer is because they can time correct everything. They can isolate the foot pedal and the snare, and they can move it around in Pro Tools and all stuff. It's like, so they can get any drummer they want to now. It's just someone with energy that can hit the skins pretty hard, and they can fix it. So it's like, Yeah, the whole recording industry has changed. A lot of people are using their own bands. Like I said, they don't have to be, you know, they don't have to have that final professional sheen to it anymore. They can do whatever they want to in post-production.
Have you had a favorite kind of period of your career, or a period you look at and say, boy, I was really – that was some cool times there? Or?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I would say that honestly, this is my favorite time. And people have come up to me by the droves and say, I can't believe how much you're smiling on stage and everywhere else. Because I was always, you know, kind of a serious guy, and maybe I was thinking about something else all the time. And then right now I just feel like I'm living every moment, and I'm getting to share this with my wife and my family members. And this is, you know, the best group I've ever put together.
That's pretty awesome.
And, you know, yeah. And I mean, it's like the, you know, the, this group deserves to be playing in Juneau at Centennial Hall. You know, that's
perfect segue to what I was going to get to.
Exactly what we need to be doing.
And Will, it's happening Friday night tomorrow. The festival finale is happening tomorrow night at 7:30. But tonight, Friday night, a couple of different things going on, right?
Yeah, that's right. So tonight, Mark's going to do this wonderful presentation about his work and about the O'Connor Method in a free program that we're calling a jam. It starts at 8 o'clock at T.K. McGuire's, and it's free, believe it or not. So come on out and have some fun. He's going to do the presentation and then show some people how to actually jam a little bit and how to improvise on some of the tunes, and then let people take it from there and just have a great time. So come on out, bring your instrument, bring your bongo drums or whatever you like, and have a drink and get to meet Mark O'Connor and do some stuff. And then tomorrow night at 7:30 at Centennial Hall is our grand finale. You can get tickets at jazzandclassics.org online, or you can come by the Jack, or just come to the door tomorrow night by 7:30.
Sounds great. Well, Mark, thanks so much for taking time with us this afternoon, and we'll play a little bit of your music on the way out here. You got another track you want me to play on here? We heard oh, Bola Bula.
Yes.
Is what we heard
Let's
before.
Let's play Coming Home.
Coming Home. I'll
my son wrote that and sings lead on it.
All right.
And we actually did the music video up in Seattle because that is my home. And that's one of our signature songs. I just love that.
All right.
And, yeah, it's just great to be able to pass music down to family members and then be able to put this on stage. It's such a profoundly wonderful way.
It wasn't planned this way, but just by chance, last fall, Jazz and Classics presented Arlo Guthrie's Generations Tour with his family. And now we've got the Mark O'Connor Band, which is amazing to have two in like 6 months of the iconic American bands.
That's really cool. Well, the Mark O'Connor Band live happening, the festival finale, tomorrow night, 7:30 at Centennial Hall. And there's a jam session happening tonight at T.K. McGuire's, in which Mark will be there and be helping give instruction and talk to folks about how to jam on the fiddle. Mark O'Connor, thanks so much for coming in and the Mark O'Connor Band. Let's play it out here with this song called Coming Home that your son wrote.
Yep.
Very awesome. We'll play it right now. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Appreciate
it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Still driving my daddy's van, my soul in the sky, my head in the sand, chasing a dream that'll